Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company, a Chicago craft brewery that works to innovate new ways to brew and age beer. More at gooseisland.com. You don't need to be the only beer you drink. We just want to be the best beer you drink.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later in the show, we'll hear from Amber Mark about the song that got her hooked on Sonics, and Greg will have a pick for the Desert Island Jukebox. But first, we are revisiting our conversation with legendary album producer Bob Ezrin.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong.
We spoke with Bob in 2011, and he was quick with stories about the recording sessions of some of the most epic rock albums of his generation. It's one of our favorites, so we thought we'd share it again.
Absolutely, Greg. You know, visionary producer Bob Ezrin's been the force behind some of the most critically acclaimed and commercially successful albums ever. Epics by Pink Floyd, Peter Gabriel, and Kiss. But his relationship with Alice Cooper was at the very start, and it's been one of the most fruitful of Ezrin's career. The two collaborated on 9 classic albums, including 1975's Welcome to My Nightmare, which we just heard. I think it's typical of Ezrin's work. He doesn't make small albums. He builds these giant skyscrapers and massive bridges, concept albums, giant constructions of sound, heavy lifting, big records. I think that's his forte. That's his trademark. In our conversation, we took Ezrin through some of those well-known albums, and we started off by asking him how he fell into music in the first place.
I was kind of born into it. People say, you know, when did you become a producer? And my mom says that I was organizing things and taking charge from the time I was one. Plus, you know, the family was all musical. My grandfather was a song and dance man. My dad played bass. My mom played piano. I really didn't have any choice. I was in the music business before I knew there was a music business.
Now, you were playing in bands at an early age. What made you gravitate towards the production side as opposed to the performance side of it?
I think that's probably most to do with my uncle's setup down in his basement, because he not only had a great collection of stuff, he had tape machines. And once a kid discovers a tape machine, all hell breaks loose. And he would let me stay down there for hours and just mess about. So I'd have microphones and tape machines. I would record. I'd pretend to be a radio announcer and would create my own shows. I just loved recording. Loved it. Plus, my siblings and I were doing a lot of television and radio from the time we were little, which was actually completely accidental. My brothers happened to be on a tour of the CBC, and they got plucked out of the crowd because they looked like they were like miniature versions of one of the guys that was a star on CBC TV who had a Saturday night show. And the producers said, "Oh my God, they look like miniature Billies. Do they sing?" And my dad said, 5, 6, 7, 8. And the boys started, you know, because we were like a singing and dancing family. So they got hired on the spot, and then they started asking if there were any more at home. And the next thing you know, we were all working all the time.
So your first gig was producing Alice Cooper's 1971 breakthrough, Love It to Death. It sort of launched both of your careers. In 1970, you were hired by Jack Richardson. He was a big-name producer at the time. He'd worked with the Guess Who. And you're supposed to run around for like $100 a week and find new talent for him, I guess, right?
Well, in fact, I was hired to be like his advance man. I was hired to do pre-production for him.
I've heard you tell this story. Max's Kansas City, you walk in, and everybody looks like a zombie. There's all this white face paint and black nail polish, black lipstick. You wind up producing that major hit, Love It to Death, in 71.
Yeah. It was an amazing time, really. The business was exploding, but it was still pretty square. I mean, people were still in T-shirts and jeans, and all, you know, every rock band kind of looked the same. And then along comes this group of lunatics of indeterminate sex wearing ballerina costumes and having mirrored instruments and playing this kind of weird-ass art rock. Nobody knew what it was. Frankly, Jack and my bosses, they were all in their 40s and really straight guys. They not only couldn't understand it, they just downright didn't like it, and they were kind of scared of it. So they sent me out to get rid of Alice Cooper. They sent me to New York and said, get rid of Alice Cooper. That's your job. So I went to Max's Kansas City. First of all, the whole place was filled with people with spider eyes and spandex, jet black hair and jet black fingernails and black lipstick. I had never seen anything like it. It was the beginning of, I guess, of the goth movement. But everybody in the joint knew every word to every song of these unreleased tunes. And this is before internet. It was an amazing thing. And the band was stunning. There was something scary, sexually exciting, you know, powerful, pounding rhythmically and all that stuff. There was something magical about what they were doing. So I went upstairs and I said, we'll do it. We will produce you because we think you can make hit records. And they said, that's great. We think you can too. And then I walked out of Max's Kansas City and I was standing out in the street in New York at 3 o'clock in the morning thinking, I am so fired.
Yeah. What kills me about that is that you were steeped in this musical background. You'd obviously studied music, classically trained in a lot of ways, and yet you had this sort of broader cultural vision. You sort of the theater of it. You kind of, it seemed to me like you had a sense of almost how big it could be, even though at the time nobody thought Alice Cooper was this amazing band. He'd already put out a couple of records that nobody cared about. Frank Zappa had worked with him, I guess, and nothing happened. You obviously had a wider vision for this sound.
Well, listen, you know, if you were in that room, you would have had the same feeling. This wasn't rock music. This was like the beginning of a cultural movement. There's no T-shirts, there's no jeans, there's lights, there's sets. They run around, they got theater, they got antics. You know, the audience looks like them. They know all the words. The songs could be amazing, blah, blah, blah. And Jack said, enough already. He said, if you like it so much, you do it.
So did you feel vindicated when the hits like I'm 18 and School's Out started coming?
Absolutely.
Of course, right?
Of course. Are you kidding? I was vindicated on a lot of levels because Warner Brothers was really, first of all, they thought that this was Jack Richardson producing this thing. And when they heard that there was this unknown kid that had zero track record, they freaked out. They would only let us do 4 songs. Jack said, I'll be there too. We're co-producing. I guarantee this will be good. And out of those first 4 songs came I'm 18. English company got a copy of this thing and it got out in England and started to take off like instantly, which sort of forced the American company's hand. And then of course, God bless Rosalie Tremblay, who was the program director at CKLW in Windsor, Ontario, a very powerful station that beamed into Detroit. And that whole region went nuts.
What you did there, too, I think it seemed like you had a role in shaping the music in a great way. Again, going back to those first couple of records, the band sounded nothing like they did once you got a hold of them. What exactly did you do with the sound? It was stripped down, it was tougher, it was leaner. Was that your influence?
Well, yes, I think so. I think everybody was willing to do this. They didn't know how. As Alice puts it, it was a band of lead players. Everybody was lead. We had lead vocals, lead drums, lead bass, you know, 2 lead guitar players. So everybody was playing everything all the time. And I think maybe my classical training helped me to orchestrate. I like to tell people that my first heavy metal artist was Tchaikovsky. When you listen to the prelude to Romeo and Juliet, when you listen to that, there's stuff in there that is so powerful, it's so big. Any heavy rock band could play it and it would just blow people away. There's always these elements. There's a melodic element, there's a counter melody, and there's a rhythmical element. And that was what I try to bring into the Alice Cooper songs, while leaving enough space for Alice. Obviously, the big thing is the story. You know, it's the the vocal melody, but it's the lyrics too. You've got to understand what he's saying because that's the essence of the song. And in doing that, things simplified, they got tighter, and they got magically more powerful suddenly.
This is Sound Opinions, and our guest is producer Bob Ezrin. Now, Bob, you did 9 albums with Alice Cooper in the 70s and 80s. Then, after a long time, you worked with him again in 2011 on Welcome to My Nightmare, to the numeral. It's a sequel. Tell me how that one came about.
It came about, they were, Shep and Alice were asked to license 5 tracks to Guitar Hero, I think. Shep is like the ultimate gentleman manager. There aren't very many left. And he called me to say, you know, we're going to re-record these songs that you recorded originally. I just want you to know that we're doing that. And oh, by the way, we'll still pay you your producer's points, but you don't have to do anything. First of all, I was totally taken aback by that because a number of bands I've worked with in the past have gone on to re-record and not paid anybody because that's just the way it is, right? So I was just like, wow, so impressed with that. And then I thought, you know what? I'm not letting anybody else touch those songs. If they're going to re-record them, I'm going to re-record them. Mm-hmm. So we went in and re-recorded 5 songs very quickly, you know, on a Guitar Hero budget, but whatever it was. And then Alice shows up in Nashville to sing the vocals. That's where I'm living, in Nashville, and I have a little studio there. So Alice shows up in Nashville to sing the vocals, walks in the front door and says, so anyway, and we were back to where we were 20 years ago, you know, the last time that we were in the studio. It nothing had changed and like we hadn't dropped a beat. It was so good. It was so instantly, comfortable is not a good word, but energizing and inspiring and exciting that after we finished doing that, we just looked at each other and went, you know, we got to keep going. This is too good. I am made of you.
You felt kind of proprietary, that this was your art. You know, obviously it's mainly Cooper's, right? His name's on it. But you had a stake in this music too. Have you felt that way about all the records you've produced?
No, nobody can feel that way about everything that they do. There are some things I'd rather forget, actually. but there are, you know, the key ones, and the ones that are mostly the ones that are already pretty popular, those ones meant a lot to me. And there's a few that people didn't really give enough attention to, in my opinion, that also mean a lot to me. Alice and I have been brothers since 1970. So that's a relationship that means a tremendous amount to me. It goes beyond the records. This is a man I love. I love Cheryl. I love the family. We've stuck together through all these years. When I got inducted into the Canadian Music Hall of Fame, there was no question as to who I wanted to have present the award. And Alice, when he got asked, he said, I'm not letting anybody else do it. Well, we got no choice.
We'll pick up our conversation with Bob Ezrin after a quick break in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.